Blog Talk Radio.
Hey there! Welcome to Big Blend Radio with your hosts, Lisa and Nancy, editors of BigBlendMagazine.com.
Welcome, everybody. Today's episode of Big Blend Radio is airing live from Austin, Texas. And as usual, your hosts, Nancy Reed and Lisa Smith. Together, we are full-time travelers on the Love Your Park store and publishers of Big Blend magazines. Yeah, traveling full-time. And it's our first time in Austin. As mother-daughter, like Nancy, I have to tell you, as a daughter, I could get into a lot of trouble here. I'm just saying.
Do you think?
Just a quick drive around the city. I'm like, oh, this is one cool city. Very cool to be here. But also very excited today to air a live show. And, hey, you may hear some dogs in the background. You never know what you can hear as we travel around. But I'm super excited to welcome back Linda Ballou. Linda is a travel writer and author of travel guides, historical fiction novels. I've been following her books over the last two years? I don't know. Can't keep track. But today she's joining us to talk about her latest novel. It's called Embrace of the Wild, inspired by equestrian explorer Isabella Bird. This woman was full of courage and really decided
badass.
She's going to do what she wants. Yeah, badass. I know you're reading it, Nancy. So you just, I just that's all I keep hearing from you. She's badass. She doesn't let anything get her down. She doesn't want to deal with the norms of society and back in the day. She wants to do what she wants to do. She doesn't care what women are supposed to be like. She deals with pain, depression. She travels, and she travels all over from England, the Sandwich Islands, goes to the Rocky Mountains, which you and I, Nancy, love. So anyway, the book is out now. It's called, again, Embrace of the Wild by Linda Ballou. You can go to lindaballouauthor.com, but also get it right on Amazon. And welcome back, Linda. How are you?
I'm fine, Lisa. Thanks so much for having me.
Hey, this is good to have you back. And you were on the show in summer of 2020 talking about writing, you know, everybody trapped in during COVID time.
Right.
And you said you decided, okay, well, I'm going to get to work and get
right.
this novel going.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, that's the thing, you know, I mean, I wrote a piece, it's called Turning Lemons to Limoncello, which is an exotic, you know, lovely drink. Instead of lemonade, it's limoncello, you know. I mean, here's the deal. I really am a travel writer, and it really was hard for me to have my wings clipped, but I could see that it was going to be a long haul on the pandemic front. And this book, this story I'd been noodling on for at least a decade. I had written a story about writing an essay, writing in the hoofprints of Isabella Bird, that won a Solis Award at Travel Tales Publishing. And I have been enthralled with this woman for many, many years. So I went, okay, all right, now's the time to do this. So taking on a novel is a big commitment. But, you know, it was the perfect time. So the thing about Isabella Bird that really intrigued me was that how our lives intersected. Her life didn't really, as a tribal writer, didn't really get going until she was like 40 years old. And that's kind of the same story for me. I didn't really get going into my travel writing life until, you know, I was in my middle years. But the distinction is that she came from, she was in the Victorian age, which was very restrictive for women. You know, women were not allowed to go to university. Mm-hmm. They were not allowed to own property. They were really expected to stay in the home, be obedient to their husbands, and, you know, devoted to their children, right? And her father was an evangelical preacher. So she was, you know,
trapped.
She was trapped in a society and an upbringing that was contrary to who she was and who she wanted to be. But the other thing that compounded her situation was the fact that she had chronic pain. She had a tumor on her spine when she was a young person, when she was about 12 or 13 in there. They operated on her to remove the tumor without any anesthesia. So in my book, I went, wow.
Yeah. I'm like, I mean,
can you imagine? Nope. I mean, back surgery with all the best surgeons in the world is scary. But to have, you know, these kinds of doctors who really didn't know what they were doing just because they just didn't have the, you know, the knowledge, it operated her without, you know, a slug of whiskey, you know.
Seriously, when I read that, my teeth hurt.
Right. And by the way, I'm writing the story first person. I am Izzy. You know, she's written 38 books in first person. But the two books that I worked from were her 6 months in the Sandwich Islands and A Lady's Life in the Rockies. The reason being because in the Sandwich Islands, which is Hawaii in 1873, she had a transformational experience that allowed her to be free of the chronic pain that she had experienced all her life. And so that first, the book goes in three parts. And the first part is all in Hawaii. And that's where she, you know, was able to overcome this tremendous pain that she was carrying with her, sack of rocks, you know, physical pain. But, you know, she learns that a lot of people don't know that the Hawaiians were big horse people. They were called Paniolas, the cowboys, the Hawaiian cowboys.
Mm-hmm,
but the
yeah.
women rode too, and the men rode, and they rode, you know, like wild banshees, and you know they would ride in a cavalcade, and they'd have, you know, flowers in their hair, and you know, ribbons flowing, and, and Isabella saw them, and she went, oh my God, you know, I have to be with them, and. She had always ridden side saddle in England. She was from Scotland, you know, England, Scotland area. And she had ridden side saddle because that's the way ladies were supposed to ride. But then she saw these women were riding astride, you know, and they were not just, you know, being looking pretty. They were galloping, you know, they were, you know, careening along the sands, and they were, you know, like, you
they
know,
were free. They were free.
They were free. That's
yeah.
right. They were free. So she saw that, and she, within the 6 months, 6 days turned into 6 months in the Hawaiian Islands. She was, it was a detour. She was on a world cruise, and, you know, this was an unplanned stop that changed her life because she learned when she rode astride that she didn't have back pain. She was freed from the back pain. And then she experiences Lomi Lomi and the Hawaiian ways of releasing pain, not just physical but spiritual. And so this whole time in the islands is a total transformation for her physically, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But then she carries on with her. She had planned to do an 800-mile mountain tour of the Rocky Mountains, right?
Why not?
Right. So she carries on.
Go ahead.
And she goes to the Rocky Mountains. Well, so that's the second part of the story. But let me just go back to my connections with her. I met her when I was researching for Wainani, A Voice from Old Hawaii, which was the first book that I published.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, right.
Her book, her very, very flowery and gifted descriptions of the islands at that time was what I used in my book to flesh out the descriptions in my book. So I, you know, absorbed her You know, I mean, I would read and reread and
so
reread.
So she was like your muse or inspiration
right,
for Wainani.
Because exactly.
Wainani, I mean, I loved Wainani because you had this woman, again, being free and also breaking away from the traditions that held women
right.
back.
Well, this
and,
is Women History Month, right?
Yeah,
yeah no kidding.
I am drawn to empowered women who have been overlooked or... I mean, Isabella Bird was the best loved travel writer of her day,
mm-hmm.
And all of her books sold. And by the way, she gave all of the profit from her books to charity.
Mm-hmm.
At any rate, Kahamanu, who was the woman that inspired Wainani, was the most powerful woman in old Hawaii, and she was responsible for the ending of the 2,000-year-old Polynesian kapu system that called for human sacrifice. So both of these women were incredible women, incredible, that, you know, I really identified with Kahumanu because she was very athletic and very sensual, and she didn't follow the rules. She broke the rules all over the place, you know. And I was in my 20s when I was like 28 when I started reading about her and learning about her. And I just identified so strongly with this person because I was breaking rules. You know, it was a time when women were breaking out. You know, there was a lot of bra burning and, you know.
mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, people were questioning the
you remember
mores.
That, Nancy?
Oh, yeah, we call them slingshots.
So I was going through a lot of questioning at that time in my life. And then so that woman, she seemed so free to me, you know, and she mm-hmm. wasn't afraid to be herself. And she was Kamehameha the Great's favorite wife out of 32 wives. She was extremely intelligent. And so I was drawn to her, and then Isabella, she is an equestrian who, in the Rockies, I'm an equestrian, I'm a horse person, right? So
mm-hmm.
I found her when I was in the Rocky Mountains. I was writing about my stories there, my experiences there, and I found her book, and I just fell in love with this woman who was so brave and you know, riding solo at that time was really quite dangerous, and she did it in the winter. And she would just ride for the day, and she'd see a light in the cabin, and she'd go knock on the door, and she'd sleep with the children and, you know, be taken. And it was the Western hospitality that she counted on, the kindness of strangers, right?
Wow.
Yeah, Wow was right. I mean,
I
think even to do that today, I wouldn't do it even today. But at that time, the Indian Wars were still happening.
Mm-hmm.
You had the gold, you know, miners. It was a very ragged and rough group with,
mm-hmm.
you know, vigilante law. And, you know, she ran into characters like Comanche Bill. And she, you know, had a love affair with Rocky Mountain Jim.
I love that.
So that's, you know, so she meets Rocky Mountain Jim, and they are two disparate characters coming from completely different backgrounds, but they're soulmates. They're, you know, they're soulmates. And so I just thought, you know, I thought it was a beautiful love story.
Yeah.
And the other thing that I did with that book, which I should mention, is that Rocky Mountain Jim had was known to be an alcoholic. He was, you know, he was a serious drinker,
mm-hmm.
but he was also very well educated, and he was like this very contradictory personality. He was it was said that if you treated him like a gentleman, you would find one, and
yeah.
this is true. Yeah, and this is true about him. So I think, you know. But nobody really knew where he came from. He declared himself the guardian of the mountains, and you
the mountain man.
Yeah, you couldn't enter into the Rocky Mountains without him, because he had his cabin on what was called Muggins Gulch, and it was a pass. And you couldn't get through without paying Rocky Mountain Jim a toll.
Ah.
But he was...
This would make a great movie.
He was a conservationist. Well, you know, the lady... I gave the book to the founder of the Equus Film Fest.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what she said. She said,
yeah,
I would really love to see this as a film.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you're in beautiful, incredibly gorgeous landscapes, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's very adventuresome. But anyway, and it's a beautiful love story. So, you know, what else do you want?
But you like love stories, Linda. I've learned this about
you.
About women.
Well, you know, without a love story, you know, you got to have that. You have to have some emotional
about
impact.
You. Yeah, you have this very strong, you know, in the books I read of yours, that you have the strong women, and they're defying the odds always, and they're based on real people, and which I think that is awesome. Nancy and I were having a conversation about you on this. Nancy's reading, and, you know, I did Wainani. She's like, I'm owning this, and I'm like, well, I'm actually starting to read this, but, you know, we each have our own thing, and so she was talking about this. I said, well, that's what Linda does. She takes, you know, historical figures and puts them into this setting, which is true of the landscape, but brings them to life. You were talking, Nancy. Nancy said you bring history to life with what you're doing.
Well, thank you. Well, that's why I write in first person. You know,
this is what they should do
in those cases, in both of those books. I am that person, right? And that seems to be the only way I can do it, is that I just simply have to become that person for a while, in my mind, you know.
In school, I hated history. Now it's my favorite thing. It's the way it was taught. Some dude reading a bunch of dates and these stupid things they'd hand out with, here's a date, it happened on this date, and the test was, what happened on one date? Multiple choice, and who cares?
Well,
I didn't care because they didn't care.
The beauty of historical fiction is that you can give people human emotions and, you know, have dialogue and a real exchange. And it's much more impactful. It's much more engaging. But even, there's many books written about Isabella, by the way, but most of them are all the ones that none of them are written first person the way I've done it, as far as I know. Actually, there's a book coming out now that a man in England wrote, which deals with her later life, because after her Hawaii and Colorado time, she then is totally liberated and self-possessed and free and of all of the baggage she was carrying, right? And she carried on. She went on to Tibet and Japan and Korea, and she wrote in places where there were no white women. People had never seen a white woman before, you know, and she wrote on yaks and elephants and, you know, she was just out there. And she, but I didn't go there because I've not been to those places, and I don't feel qualified to write about them even. But this man, he's written something very academic. You know, it's scholarly.
Yeah.
It's dry.
Yeah.
It's not, you know.
It's facts, ma'am. Nothing but facts.
There's no sense of a love story or any of that.
Right.
Stuff.
There's a documentarian way of doing things, or there's a romanticizing of it so that people get the feeling and the emotion of what it could be. And that's something I wanted to ask you, Linda. You've traveled all over the world. You've traveled across this country. And there's something about being in a place where when you go and you step, everywhere we step is history, right, no matter where it is.
Sure.
And some places feel deeper than others. Colorado definitely has this, you know, there's certain states that just, wow, Colorado's wild, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And there is a sense of history, and you start to feel who was there before you, and you have this idea of what was it like to live there. So does that influence your writing to be able to write in first person because you've been to places and had the feeling of the past?
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, I think landscape forms who we are. You know, wherever you live, like, you know, I'm from Alaska, right? So you're a little bit tougher. You're a little bit, you know, a little more self-reliant. You're also a little more careful, respectful out in the woods. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And whereas if you're from Hawaii, you know, you're much more relaxed. You're much more casual. You're much more easygoing. I mean, the environment isn't going to kill you, generally speaking, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, you don't have to be quite as careful, but different. It's different. So I think wherever
mm-hmm.
you live, is landscape forms us, and so
sure.
I don't want to write about a place where I haven't been. And part of I never mm-hmm. and I research heavily before I write, and the research is half the fun.
Mm-hmm.
Like for Colorado, for instance, I mean, I love Colorado, and I
yeah.
love writing in it, and I love reading about it. And one of the things about Colorado, of course, is the indigenous people, the Native Americans.
Mm-hmm.
And so the history there of the Sand Creek Massacre, once again,
mm-hmm.
I did this in three parts, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And because Mountain Jim did not have a history, I gave him a history. I provided him with a history, a backstory,
mm-hmm.
That on a topic that, you know, I wanted to put a shine a light on, and that is the Sand Creek Massacre, which was put
mm-hmm.
under the rug for many, many, many years
mm-hmm.
by the historians, because the people in Denver didn't want to acknowledge that there was a very, very, very foul
it's
happening
horrible.
There, you know. And so I wanted people to know about that. It became a national monument, I think, in like 2005. So it's not, you know, people know about it now.
Mm-hmm.
But for 100 years, it was swept
mm-hmm.
under the rug. And
yeah,
we,
sure.
you know, we know about Custer's Stand. We know
yeah.
about a lot of
mm-hmm.
the massacres that have taken place, right? But this particular one was in that region. And I decided to do that, to make it part of
mm-hmm.
the story, because it was something that when I read about it, I was shocked.
Mm-hmm.
And I just felt that it was important to tell the story from the Native American point of view. And that's what I tried
mm-hmm.
to do with Jim. Jim lives with his best friend is Running Deer, who,
mm-hmm.
you know, is a warrior. And he's in the Peace Chief Black Kettle's village, and Black Kettle was very important in the Indian Wars, and that time period was very important. So
I
made that part of the story.
Mm-hmm.
I took that liberty, and nobody is. It's funny. I'm getting good reviews on the book. Nobody's
yeah.
mentioning the massacre. Nobody's saying to me, oh, wow.
People don't
want
to talk about
it. Well, there's that, and then also because people don't want to talk about those kind of things. And also, it's a very, you know, that is a remote area. South Colorado and that part, southeast, very remote. Nancy and I've driven past there, but it's always been like 2 in the morning through La Junta and that area. It's on the way to Kansas. And but also in southeast Arizona's Ludlow, and there's a massacre site there, but it was actually about the National Guard shooting at miners, and it's a horrible.
Yeah,
yeah
no,
you go in there. It is chilling, and you go there, and these women and children went underground, and the tomb thing is there where they hid while they were shooting at the miners. It was back in the 1920 or something like that. And this was a skirmish that happened that is also overlooked. And it's a very untraveled portion in a way. You know what I mean? It's
mm-hmm.
people go to Santa Fe or they go to Denver, but these are outlying areas. And, you know, people are going to go, well, why would I go to a massacre site? And it's important to go to these massacre sites because things happen and they're still coming back now. We have to learn history. So I think so important. And Colorado is like so many massacres happened. I don't know if it's that's why I feel so much history when I'm there. I always feel like it's prehistoric. You feel the prehistoric.
Well,
I know
you
it's rich in
the
oil.
Dinosaurs. You've got
yeah,
the dinosaurs.
Yeah, the dinosaurs.
I love dinosaurs.
I know.
I
it's
really,
such an
I
amazing
love
state.
Dinosaurs.
It's an amazing state.
It is an amazing state. I just got through reading The Gold Digger, which is Baby Doe's story, and that was all set in the mining days there, which, you know, is a little bit later than my book. Very close, though, to the same time period.
Mm-hmm.
And there was, you know, a lot going on there. They had the Chinese workers, and then when the mines went bust, they decided to kill all the Chinese people, you know. I mean, there's a lot of stuff going on in Colorado that they don't talk about.
That happened in Arizona, in Prescott. When we were in Prescott, Arizona, this is about 10 years ago. Oh, yeah, way over 10, 15 years ago. We were publishing our magazine. Yeah, it was when we were in print. And we'd travel through Prescott, and we'd get stuck in Whiskey Row for more reasons than one. And we were in an Irish bar, and this guy was sitting there. He's known as a Renaissance man of Prescott.
Oh, gosh.
He was showing us that there were Chinese that were trapped under, like, where we were sitting upstairs.
They were chained to the wall underneath the bar.
There were things going up and down. What do you call it? The
dumbwaiter
things? Dumbwaiter that goes down. And it proved that the Chinese were working underground, delivering food up to the people, but they were hidden. And even, like, the museums don't want to acknowledge that the Chinese were there. Maybe a few opium pipes and stuff like that, but no...
They built the railroad.
They try to hide that there's discrimination. That's what the guy was talking about. Mm. Doesn't mean it's true. So don't email me about this. I didn't do it. But I think we were hiding that stuff way back when.
Right.
And there's a lot of people that are dead that we don't know about. Let's just put it that way.
Yeah. Well,
this is a nice conversation. We just
I was going to say we're a little off track here. But it's true.
I mean, if you go into the history, but at the same time, what I'm going back into it, when women really bucked the system, you know, like Isabella Bird did, Wainani.
Right.
Isabella Bird's story also reminds me of Frida Kahlo, the artist. I mean, look at her back problems and what she went through. And then
artist. She was an incredible... I mean, that woman, you know, was never freed. She was never freed from the pain, maybe just temporarily a little bit when she went to Europe and in France. But she was basically in pain all her life. Isabella actually became free of the torment. She suffered from melancholy and what they called lassitudes, which was, you know, depression.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of it had to do with the fact that she was living in England, and Scotland particularly was very dreary. And, you know, once again, landscape forms us, right? And she was so impacted by that dreadful cold and dreariness and the fact that then she had headaches, she had migraines, and the fact that the doctors, what the doctors did, her back continued to be painful for her, right? Because all the things they were doing for her were wrong. And they made a brace, a metal and leather brace that they put around her midsection. And it, you know, put welts under her arms and on her hips and, you know, lacerations, you know, from this ridiculous brace that they had her in so that she could, you know, they told her she needed it to stand erect. You know, in our day and age, we would do exercises. We'd build up our muscles, you know. We wouldn't be, you know, put into, like, you know, a medieval brace. And so here she was living in the effect of all of these, you know, doctors and people who didn't know what they were doing. And they were trying to help her. They wanted to help her, but they, you know, were exacerbating the situation. And then finally, at the age of 40, she picked up and said, "You know what? I'm leaving England. I'm going on a world voyage, and I'm out of here." And then then there was a storm that caused her to end up in Hawaii. So landscape does form us.
It does. It's interesting. Yeah, it does form us. We did an interview with the doctor who actually diagnosed seasonal distress disorder, like the seasonal disorder that you have. Like if you live, you get upset. We actually interviewed him. He's a, and we actually interviewed him in regards to transcendental meditation, which he's a big part of. And he did all the scientific research on this, and he did the seasonal distress disorder, and he said it happens. If you are a person that's used to running out in the sunshine and all of a sudden it gets dark and gloomy, you take on that persona. And people think it's woo-woo, but it's not. I know that.
It's
just
not
going,
really.
We you know, we lived in Kenya for so many years, and I was raised out in the tropics. Then we went to England, and I love England. So everyone, please, we love it. But we, like, this is, we can't do this. And so then we went from England back to South Africa. And they even made me stand up in school and say, why on earth would your parents make you move back to Africa, the wilds of Africa? And I said, because there's sunshine and animals.
Yeah.
And it's fun. But that happens.
Fun.
But I understand that. But it's interesting when, you know, looking at the whole medical thing, what she went through, but also thinking about the travel writing part. Because women, back then, you have to have like a chauffeur, not a chauffeur, but like you have to have a
right.
person, a chaperone.
Yeah,
guardian. You can't
exactly.
just
well, okay,
travel.
So her first book, when she was 23, her father was a preacher, and she was chronically ill, you know, when she was young, and so her father thought, well, it'll be a good thing if she does a voyage, and that's what they did a lot in those days, you know, they take sea cruises because you
the
know that was
air.
The way that was the way you got around, you know, you didn't fly. So he says, all right, Isabella, you know, I want you to go to the New World, and I want you to go to these various churches over there, and I want you to report back to me. I'm writing a book about it, and you get the information for me, and here's £100, and, you know, stay as long as in a letter of introduction, and, you know, see how far it gets you. So her first trip, and the mother agreed to this idea because she wanted her to get a husband. You know, at 23, you're a spinster. You know,
yeah.
you're
what the heck?
You're in deep trouble. So the mother said, okay, she can go, but she has to be with a chaperone. She must be with an escort at all times. It's unseemly for a young woman to travel alone.
Mm-hmm.
So her first voyage did produce her first book, but it wasn't the beautiful travel writing that she did later on. You know, I mean, it was, you know, a little bit dry on the dry side for starters, and a lot of it had to do with the religious activities, and she hated having an escort. You know, she tried to get away from the escort. She couldn't, you know, she couldn't have freedom in her movements. But she did enjoy the New World, and she enjoyed exploring, and, you know, she went down to the, you know, she went to New York, and she went down to the slave states, as she called them, and, you know, because slavery was really, really raging at the time. And, my book is taking place just as the Civil War is ending. So I put in one of the characters in the story is a Buffalo soldier, which is a black man, because after the war, a lot of the black soldiers didn't really know what to do with themselves. You know, they couldn't go back to the South. So they went west, and they became what's called the Buffalo soldiers. And they, you know, guarded the wagon trains and things like that. And one of the characters at the lodge she stays at in the Rocky Mountains is a Buffalo soldier. And he talks about his experiences with the Indians and things. So you get his point of view of what was going on at that time. And Mountain Jim's father wanted him to enlist, wanted him to go to the Civil War. And Jim refused. He was not exactly a conscientious objector. He just didn't want to kill people, but he didn't believe in the, he didn't want to be there. His brother had already died in the war, and he chose not to do that, and so he was, so his father kicked him out of the house.
Wow. I like what you're doing, because you're giving all these different personalities, which you just don't get, you know, if you're reading sometimes you read documentation, but if you're trying to, if you're going to bed at, like Nancy goes at night, give me a novel. I want my novel. Like,
yeah,
I'll go, hey, we need to read this and this. I don't care. I need a novel. I'm not going, it's not going to go in if it doesn't have that feeling or that emotion that you can grasp into and delve into the characters and attach to. And you want that. That's how you understand. And I think that's what's so beautiful with what you're doing with, you know, and it is a big endeavor because you're also being like historically accurate in regards to this is what went down. You know what I mean? The, there's the personalities, but here's the, there's that balance that you're walking a tightrope on it. And that's got to be hard to do.
Well, the hardest thing, yeah, the hardest thing for me to, was not to plagiarize because I was, you know, using her books as a roadmap, and but I added characters in there that she didn't have. I mean, I added things to make it, you know, more to fictionalize the story. And I threw in the Buffalo Soldier because I thought he was important, you know, that and once again, the Native American point of view, I thought that was important. It's important in these days, in these times. And, you know, those people were evolving at that time and in the West. And the miners, I didn't go too much into the mining times. But if you're interested in that, the book that I just read, like I said, Gold Digger, Baby Doe's story, deals a lot more with the politics of that time and the mining industry and what went on with all of that.
I wish they would take historic novels and put them in history classes and maybe more than one author. So that the debate can be, oh, well, she wrote about this and he wrote about that and he said this, she said that, and debate it and then come in with the, you know, the historical facts, which
it,
the
it depends
novels are
on the
based
age.
On. No, but I think it would be, I think people would embrace history far more if you make it live.
If you make it more human,
Yeah, because some of, like, the history books are the, you might as well read an algebra book and you come away with the same, what the, are you talking about?
I didn't do well in math either, Nancy.
Well,
I did good in it, but
we're talking
I had to
about
make up my own
today.
Stuff. I mean, algebra, I was okay with 1, 2, and then when it got to 3, 4, and let's have trigonometry, I'm like, I'm bailing. This is
listen. I know how to add up money. That's the important thing. I can add up money in bank accounts and stuff.
And
I can do all that.
And the teachers kept saying, you're going to need this for your career. I'm like, I'm not going to do what? Now, geometry, I loved. I got that.
Well,
you're
you know, some women are, you know, inclined in that direction. And, you know, the people who are just sending the rockets up, you know, there are
all the
lots
scientists.
Of females that are into it. But I was an English major, and that's what I loved. And, you know, that's what I still love. And, you know, I really enjoy trading books with other authors and writing reviews. And, you know,
that's cool.
It's what I love.
Do you remember the first time you heard about Isabella, like where you went, oh, I'm interested in her? What was the very first moment? Like, I know you read another book about her, but...
Well, it was in the Sandwich Islands, 6 months in the Sandwich Islands, because I published Wainani in 2009, and I was researching for that book years
prior. I love Wainani. Everyone's got to read that. That's awesome. I love that. They're not riding horses. They're riding dolphins. But, you know, and horses.
Why not? That's right.
There's horses
well,
in there, too.
So, initially I was introduced to her there. But then when I became a travel writer, one of my first gigs was in Telluride, Colorado.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful.
And that's where I started researching and, you know, books that had to do with the mountains, Rocky Mountains. And that particular area is the San Juans, but it's, you know, similar, you know, 14,000 foot peaks and absolutely gorgeous.
Mm-hmm.
And and then I, you know, wrote a story called Have Boots Will Travel, which started in Durango, and I did the San Juan Skyway Loop. And there's a tremendous amount of history on that loop, especially mining history.
Oh, yeah,
at the top. you've got the Durango train that goes mm-hmm. up through the Animas on the Animas River and mm-hmm. goes up to Silverton where the mine was and mining town, and you know, it's about at 12,000 feet, and it's, you know, very scenic and historic, and I did a lot of research there. And also, Mesa Verde is on that loop, too. So you have the Anasazi ruins. I mean, so all of that was very fascinating. And I did a lot of reading, and there she was, Lady of the Rockies. Mm. There she was. There was Izzy. And I haven't read all of her works. Like I said, I have no intentions, I don't think, of going to Tibet or Bhutan or, you know, I mean.
Not now.
At this juncture, I think for travel, I'm going to do domestic travel for this year. Mm-hmm. I planned a little jaunt up the Central Coast on April Fool's Day.
Sweet. Awesome. Cool. Awesome. Maybe we'll see. Cool. We'll be in the Sequoias in mid-month. We'll be like in the Sequoias. We haven't been to California for so long. I'm like, oh, it's been over a year. I'm kind of homesick, you know. But, you know,
it's gorgeous.
Yeah.
It's gorgeous here right now. We're finally getting the rain that we needed so much. The oak trees have been literally falling over and dying, you know. Hundreds of them, but you know, we're getting the much needed rain, and so I think we're going to be out of this drought that we've been in for about 5 years.
Oh, wow, really?
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah.
Oh,
and so
that's amazing.
And I love the coast, and I just wrote a piece called Cruising on the Central Coast for Travel World. The editor asked me to do a road trip piece, right? So I did it, and I went, I want to go.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't want to just write about this. I want to go. So mm-hmm. I made some reservations, and I'm really looking forward to it. I've had my shots, and even though
good.
That's the case, I still, you know, I'm going to be very careful and
mm-hmm.
Follow protocols. And you know, I really think we're not out of the woods for sure.
Nope, not yet. But
so. This year, I think domestic travel, I'd like to go up to Oregon. I had a river trip lined up there in the Rogue River Valley.
Oh, yeah, I remember that, yeah.
And that I had to cancel because of the pandemic.
Aww.
But it's the river is still there. And even though they had, you know, really bad fires in Oregon, and
mm-hmm.
I don't know exactly what the area is looking like now, but... you know, maybe I should. I feel like I want to go up and, you know, report back and let people know what it is. And I want to go there. I like Oregon a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. I like Colorado. I'd like to go to Colorado in the fall. This book is set in the fall. She was writing from like September to December in, you know, for this, in the time frame that this book takes place. And I've been in Colorado in the spring, which is absolutely gorgeous with the wildflowers and all, but I think the fall color might be pretty spectacular.
Yeah.
And I'd like to do a road trip in there to the scenic byways through that region, and I'm planning it. Half of the fun is the planning.
Mm-hmm.
That's what
I highly recommend Grand Mesa if you get a chance. Grand Mesa.
Which one?
Grand Mesa. It's
Grand
in the Grand Mesa.
Mesa.
Mm-hmm.
It's in the northwest, so I know it's kind of out of the area, but it's the western slope, as they call it.
Mm-hmm.
And we did that last year when the pandemic was, in, you know, full throttle, but it was like we could leave California at that point. We were, like, housebound for 3 months, and then, okay, we can leave and go do this, and... Very, I mean, we're still masked up. I mean, basically, we're running around the country in a big bodysuit that's called, I don't know, you know, we're being really, really careful in everything we do. Hence why we pet sit, because we're able to be in a home and quarantined in a way, like everywhere we go. And
we are,
so, sorry about dog barks through podcasts, everybody, but, you know, we're doing the best. Everybody has to do the best they can do, right?
Hey,
well, I think
you
two are pretty amazing to have been traveling through this whole time, honestly.
We're smart. We're being really, really smart about it, and it's, you know, and if you can't, honestly, you'll sleep in your car before you go somewhere you don't trust. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You do what you need to do. But I want to tell you, Grand Mesa, though, go back to that Grand Mesa.
Okay.
We've done a lot of the scenic routes in Colorado, a ton of them, especially in 2019. We did a lot of Colorado. Grand Mesa blew our minds.
Awesome.
I'm just saying.
I read about the hot, I think it's called Sulphur Springs. It has these hot mineral springs. And instead of staying in Estes Park, which is very, very popular, very, very charming, very sweet, really a lovely little town, which is the gateway to the Rocky Mountain Park, right? But it tends to be quite busy on that side of the park. And then the Sulphur Springs place is not on that side of the park and not a big town, and I'm thinking that sounds good to me, you know. I might have to drive a little bit to get to the main gate to get into the park, but I'll be on the back side rather than on the very, and I'll have a hot springs to come home to, a mineral
that
hot
is so
spring.
Cool.
I think that's way better. I think avoiding crowds is a really good thing.
You know, even before the pandemic, I was always doing that.
I
will say that's been the joy of our travels. That last year was like where it was so quiet, like everywhere was quiet and the parks were quiet, and you didn't like, you know, have people on their cell phones while you're trying to look at a bird. You know what I mean?
Well,
so
it's just the opposite.
There was a beauty
here.
Of that.
It's just the opposite here because I live in the Santa Monica Mountains, and we our trails, during the week, you can go on the trails and it's okay. But during the weekend, they're just mobbed because people are still not able, they're still not back to work, you know. And
yeah.
So they want to be outdoors, and I understand that.
Oh, yeah.
And I have the choice. I can go during the week, right? But on the weekends, it's the beaches and the trails are just packed. And so, you know,
yeah,
I think
we've experienced some of that depending on where we were. Like when we were in Gettysburg, it was like people were crawling over the monuments, and it was on a weekend. And we were just, we got to a point of, it was an overload. It was overwhelming to be in a battlefield like that. And then it was overwhelming just the history and the nature. We just eventually, we did the majority of the park, but we didn't go into any of the things like the diorama thing, that big one, the cyclorama. We didn't do that.
Yeah.
Because it was just, people were going in, like too many people, and we're like, no
way.
We found picnic benches and a picnic site, and we got up, and we were like secluded because everybody's doing the stuff, you know, the touristy stuff too. Not saying that the town is, anyway, it was just, we had to get away, you know, that's the thing we do. It's like when we feel we need to get away, we do. But we saw the biggest woodpeckers and cardinals ever. We sat there having our picnic, and we're just like hanging out with the birds, and a friend called them like, sorry, dude, but like there's this biggest woodpecker right now that I'm filming, and he's hopping on the ground more than he is in the trees, and it was the coolest. I got good footage. Everyone will see it down the road. But, you know, that's how you have to do it.
One of the messages in the book, or the big message in the book, of all my books, everything that I do, is that nature can be our salvation, right? And being alone in nature is really important. And Isabella, you know, becomes centered in her, she has a little cabin there in Estes Park, and it's all just her. And for the first time in her life, you know, she has absolute serenity and solitude and in nature, and it transforms her.
Believe in that.
You know, it allows everything to settle into place for her. So, and I think it's really important not to be around too many people. So when I go, like I say, even before the pandemic, I was always, I mean, one of the pieces I wrote was Not Enough Said for Solitude. That one set in Sedona. My attitude everywhere.
One of the things I see lately that really I find really disturbing is people like in Gettysburg, especially children, where their parents don't say, hey, don't walk over the graves.
Yeah, geez. No respect.
And they have their kids, and they have cell phones, and they're looking at their cell phones as they walk over graves, and the parents are looking at their cell phones, and I'm like, you know, come on.
Yeah. Mm. Little respect.
A lady yelled at me.
Can't you put the phones away?
But wait,
seriously?
Check this out. It was so funny. Remember we're in Presque Isle State Park up in Pennsylvania, Erie, Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
And this state park, I have to say, like, should be on national park status.
Oh, it's so beautiful.
It's incredible. The history, you've got the War of 1812, you've got Perry the Commodore, you've got Commodore Perry, and you've got lighthouses, and
That's just beautiful.
The history is intense, but the nature, just even on this little spit of an island going out, is so biodiverse. You can go kayaking, you can go out into the lake, and then, like, I don't know if you want to kayak there, not in winter because they get ice, but they have bogs and marshes, and
it's
just
so cool.
Magical. And so we had just been to Asbury Woods, it's like a nonprofit with the woods. And we were talking about this balance between cell phones and getting out into nature. And I'm very, like, purist, you know, no. And she's like, well, actually, our kids, the way we're getting them into it is through using the Seek app on iPads or on their phones.
Yeah,
and
cool.
They go out, and next thing you know, I'm hooked. And I put the app on my phone. It's iNaturalist. It's done through National Geographic and California Science. I don't know. I'm going to get them on a show. I got to get them on a show. And you go out and Seek. It's an app. This app is so cool. You put it on your phone or your iPad or whatever you want to do, and you can scroll over a plant or a bug or whatever, and it will try and propagate depending what species it is, right? And you can post your observation online. Well, if you go online and fill out your profile, we've got one for the Love Your Park store. I'm starting to put up all my bug and animal and bird and plant things you don't know, because we've gone through so many different places. Like, I'm like, what's a woodpecker in California? Ain't the same woodpecker back east, you know?
No, not at all.
It's teaching us these species. So between the app and then the online, people go in and say, no, it's this species, no, it's that. So they basically, everybody dukes it out, and then this is the species. And it's used in citizen science, and all these research people are using my imagery because it will document when your phone took it, where it was. And so it's like they have true data to look at what's going on, whether it's an invasive species, not. So when we left Asbury Woods and we got there and we're like, dude, this is so cool. Then that same day we went back to the Presque Isle State Park because we had an interview to do and everything. And so before we did the interview, we're taking a little trail. And I'm using the phone because now I'm like, dude, what are these pods, you know, seed pods? And we found this big wasp nest and everything. This girl comes by on a bicycle, get off your phone, you're in a park. I'm speaking. I'm looking at iNaturalist. I'm fine. I'm doing the right thing. So you don't know. Some people on their phone could be doing that. So I'm just going
to
say.
Well, I'll have to check that out.
It's so cool. It's so cool.
Yeah, the app that I like is the All Trails. Are you familiar with
that? Yeah.
All Trails. That's a really handy one to have.
Because we get lost.
Well, I mean, you know, like when I go to Colorado or when I go to Oregon or when I go wherever, you know, I mean, it's really pretty cool. You know, for the Central Coast, I thought I knew all the trails. Well, I don't. I'm eager to get up there again and try some of the ones that I've found on this site. And they give good directions. It's a really handy little site. I like it.
You know, I think it's pretty easy to tell when you're in a natural place and people have their phones. They're either looking at the phone for directions or the phone is telling them it's this and that, as opposed to a full-fledged conversation, which is always louder than everything else. So you can tell when a person is using a phone to talk to somebody else as opposed to looking up an app. It's pretty simple.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's true. It's true. And you've got to think about everybody around you and the animals. And the birds and the plants don't need that. They don't need it. They are, you know, however we go into the woods or the beach or the prairie, there we are affecting them every time. So it's important. So I love this. Linda, very exciting. Are you going to put this into an audiobook, Embrace of the Wild?
No, I don't think so, because it would require two narrators. It's first person female for the first section, and then first person male for the second section. I would require. I don't know. I don't think so. I don't think it's that conducive. But I tell you what, I am going to do. I'm going to make a proposal and submit it and see if I can get some film people interested in it, because it is very. It's very beautiful settings. It's cinematically could be very, very beautiful. So,
I think you should.
I might go that route more than the audiobook route.
Awesome. Awesome. Very cool. Everybody, again, you can keep up with Linda at lindabellewauthor.com. Also get her books on Amazon, especially Embrace of the Wild, Inspired Questing Explorer, Isabella Bird. I also want to give a shout out to Wainani, because they're connected, and I love the book Wainani. You got to go get Wainani. I think they really connect. And of course, keep up with our shows at bigblendradio.com. And we're going to close with some music. And I felt like this is a good song. It's from our friend James Saunders over in South Africa. It's called Freedom Has a Way. And this is actually part of, I always looked at it in a different light. And then one day on the show, he said, actually, this is about me backpacking across the, across Europe and traveling. So, he was like, backpacking is freedom. And I thought, well, this is pretty similar in a lot of ways to Isabella's story. So here it is. Freedom Has a Way. Thank you so much, Linda. It's always a pleasure.
All right, it's great to talk to you. If you get to my area, give me a call.
Oh,
we will.
We'll go for a hike, a one-hour walk with masks on, right? We'll do it.
All right.
We'll do it.
We always warn people when you say that. We're coming.
Okay.
All right, and we'll bring the wine for afterwards, okay? Okay.
All right.
Here it is. Take care, everybody. Here it is. Freedom Has a Way. And enjoy that Central Coast beauty, man. That place is magical. Like, there's whales and stuff out there, so enjoy.
Thank you.
What will you say? black and white, it's always written in grey. Just a handful of memories to write down in the sand. But these things that are fallen so deep inside are never easy to understand. Never easy to understand. Light the